Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Republican celebration over the passage of their so-called tax reform bill and get an assessment of the sycophantic praise showered on Donald Trump in a wave of self-congratulation from GOP lawmakers and Trump's obsequious cabinet, who ritually paid homage to their president as though he was North Korea's dear leader. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Road of the Modern Economy Are Structured to Make the Rich Richer, joins us to discuss the obscenity of celebrating a massive gift to corporate America and the richest Americans while taking away healthcare coverage for millions of Americans and letting the Children's Health Insurance Program CHIP lapse, endangering the health of millions of American children. Then we'll speak with Jason Furman, a professor of the practice of economic policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, who served as the top economic advisor to President Obama and was the 28th chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, acting as both President Obama's chief economist and a member of his cabinet. He joins us to discuss the difference between the economy that Obama inherited and the one that Obama handed over to Trump, that Trump is taking credit for. We will examine whether this unpopular tax bill will end up punishing the Republicans in 2018, or will the rosy projections of trickle-down benefits on top of a robust economy ensure that all branches of the government will remain in GOP hands. Then finally, we will look into the fate of the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, which is languishing in Congress from neglect, with its benefits to millions of American children about to expire, and speak with Joan Alka, the executive director of the Center for Children and Families. A research professor at the Georgetown University McCourt School of Public Policy, she joins us to discuss the dysfunction and indifference of the Congress to keeping alive a bipartisan program started by Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy and Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. And joining us now, Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author, most recently, of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And his latest book is Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Bubbles Are Back. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks, Dean. And there seems to be two schools of thought. The Republicans, all of whom are absolutely overjoyed by the passage of their so-called tax reform bill. And there was a lot of celebration and a lot of unctuous praise of the dear leader, Donald Trump, particularly in a cabinet meeting that was absolutely dreadful, embarrassing, to say the least.
It was embarrassing.
But you've got reports now that corporate America, who are the big winners along with the super rich, are going to pump some money into the economy. The head of Bank of America is saying that Comcast is going to give their employees a little bit of a bonus. So is corporate America going to play along with this idea that this is going to be good for everybody in the trickle-down sense?
Well, you know, I don't think anyone thought none of the tax cuts to corporations were going to end up in workers' pockets. You know, most of the estimates from, you know, the opponents, or I shouldn't say opponents, because all these people are like working for the government, as far as I know, neutral. I have no idea what their view was. But in any case, you know, somewhere in the order of 10 to 20% of the corporate tax cuts would end up as higher wages. And, you know, one of the ones you mentioned, Comcast, AT&T, they both said that they'd give a $1,000 bonus to their workers. And the two points to make about that, one is that it's a bonus. It's not an increase in their pay. Now, in the story, they're supposed to see higher pay as an ongoing matter, because the tax cut were not a one-year, this wasn't a one-year tax cut, it's a permanent tax cut. So why isn't the pay increase permanent? But on top of that, again, I just did the arithmetic with AT&T. Eyeballing it, they stand to have a tax reduction on the order of over $2 billion a year. If you look at $1,000 per worker for 200,000 workers, I mean, those are their numbers, that comes to $200 million. That's 10% of the tax cut. So, I mean, I'm glad to see workers getting something, but, you know, they're getting one-tenth of what the company's getting. So that's pretty much in line with what many of us thought would happen, that they'd get something, but most of it's going to go to the corporation, go back to their shareholders as stock buybacks or dividends, which to most people I don't think sounds like a very good story.
But that's not the story that Paul Ryan's putting out. He's saying that in time, people are just going to love this. I mean, the hyperbole that was coming out yesterday from all of those beaming faces who've just passed this massive so-called tax reform bill, that everybody that's analyzed it just about says it's really weighted in favor of corporate America and the super rich. We know, and in fact, Trump said this is the end of Obamacare. Well, how could they be proud of putting, you know, millions of Americans are taking away their health care? And of course, you've got the CHIPS program that's languishing and hasn't been renewed. So here you are throwing extra treasure at the super rich, and hundreds of thousands of American children are going to go hungry.
Well, I don't think there's much explanation other than they just don't care. I mean, the CHIPS program just shows it very clearly. I mean, none of this was a surprise, just so everyone understands. This is state children health insurance program. It was started under Clinton, President Clinton, but bipartisan support. Gingrich, the Republican Congress, supported. So this has had widespread support across the aisles, you know, since the late 90s. And it's been hugely successful, covered, you know, millions of kids and improved their health. So it really shouldn't be a debatable point. But here it is. The funding authorization expired for it at the end of the fiscal year, September 30th. None of this was a surprise. It was all on the calendar. Everyone knew about it. They couldn't be bothered to reauthorize it. And you have states now running out of money. I don't know if anyone have yet shut down clinics, but, you know, they're near that point. They're certainly very near that point. And they just don't want to be bothered with it. So it just, what can you say? Here it is. They're pushing this big tax cut. And here's this program that everyone agrees, great program. Millions of kids depend on it. And they just can't be bothered to reauthorize it. It's kind of incredible.
Yeah, but Dean, it was championed by Hillary Clinton, the devil incarnate.
That's right. No, she was the one who pushed it. I mean, obviously, she alone didn't get it through, but, you know, she you know, that was something she took on after the initial health care proposal in 93, 94 went down in flames. She picked up the idea, okay, let's agree that we should insure kids. So, yeah, it has her handwriting on it, and maybe that's... that's the issue. Again, what can you say for people that, you know, for whatever reason, that I don't care whether they're right or wrong to hate Hillary Clinton, the immediate issue here is millions of kids getting health care. So, you know, send her a nasty Christmas card or something. But, I mean, this is millions of kids. There's nothing, at this point, there's nothing to do with Hillary Clinton.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And his latest book is Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Bubbles Are Back. So we've got this rosy forecast from the Republicans and Paul Ryan basically saying, just wait, this is just going to be so good. And early next year, people will start seeing their paychecks and they're just going to be thrilled with this whole thing. And all of this criticism will be absolutely exposed. And Trump, of course, is angry of the coverage so far. So what's the reality then? The people who have told us that this is a disaster, it's going to blow the debt up by $1.5 trillion, and it's going to just add more wealth to the already wealthy, and the corporations, they're going to get a windfall or pay less taxes, but that's not going to translate necessarily into jobs. That's the one narrative, and we've already looked at the other narrative. So what's your sense of where we're heading here?
Well, the people saying it's a disaster are wrong in the sense that the economy is not going to collapse over this. We are going to have more debt, but people don't see the debt unless they're reading publications from the Congressional Budget Office. You know, in other words, you and I, we go down the street, we go to our jobs, whatever we're doing, we don't see the government debt. We only see the government debt if it causes something bad to happen. And frankly, I don't see any story where it will cause anything bad to happen, at least not anytime soon. This isn't to say that at some point ever, you know, we couldn't have a problem with government debt, but we're very far from having that point. So in that sense, I think Ryan might actually be closer to right, not that his tax cut's doing anything good, but we basically have a pretty healthy economy now. It grew 3% in the third quarter. It's on track to grow more than 3% in the fourth quarter. Nothing to do with their tax cut. It just, you know, the economy is finally picking up steam. Workers, as you get the unemployment rate down, workers are getting more bargaining power. You are seeing some increase in wages, particularly at the middle and the bottom. So we actually have a pretty healthy economy, and I don't see this tax cut as derailing it. So in that sense, if the Democrats are saying, oh, my God, look at this, they passed the tax cut, something's horrible is going to happen, well, that's not true. So in that sense, the Republicans, Paul Ryan, may end up not looking that bad because odds are, as I say, we're going to have good growth in the fourth quarter. I don't see it suddenly stopping come 2018. The unemployment rate's likely to continue to go down. So if you know, the Democrats are touting, oh, my God, we're going to see a disaster, we aren't going to.
Well, but the president, of course, he's going to save, Donald Trump is going to save between $11 and $15 million per year due to the cuts. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is expected to save up to $12 million. Betsy DeVos will receive a tax cut of $2.7 million. And Trump's heirs stand to save $4.5 million, as do the families of Commerce Secretaries Wilbur Ross and Steve Mnuchin at Treasury, even Rex Tillerson. So, little wonder.
It's unbelievably corrupt. I mean, this is money that we could have been using. We were talking a moment ago about health care. Okay, so we could have been extending the Children's Health Insurance Program. We were talking before about the Affordable Care Act being dismantled. Well, it's being in large part dismantled. We could be using this money to extend health care insurance coverage, to reduce the cost, have a Medicare buy-in. There's all these useful things we could have been doing with this money, but we're not. So in that sense, it's really bad news. On the other hand, if we're saying, oh, the economy is going to collapse because we have a bigger debt, that's not true.
Well, I don't know that anybody's saying that, but in general, the main, and let's face it, this is unpopular with the American people. And are they wrong, the majority of Americans, seeing this as a giveaway to corporate America and the super rich?
Oh, they're absolutely right in that. And it is an outrage. These are the people that have gotten the bulk of the gains from economic growth for the last four decades. So how does the government respond? We go, oh, let's give them more. So people are absolutely right. And beyond just giving it to the rich, as you said, a lot of this is literally just straight-out pork barrel stuff. You had Senator Corker, who was originally against it because he increased the deficit, suddenly turns around. What do you know? There's a provision in there that has a lower tax rate for real estate investment. Guess who has millions of dollars in real estate investments? Senator Corker. So people are absolutely right to be outraged about this. I'm just saying it's not going to sink the economy.
Right, but I guess the political question, Dean Baker, is it going to rescue the Republicans? This is the most unpopular president since they've done polling, from what I understand. And he's got this millstone around his neck of the Russia inquiry. Now they're trying to distract everybody through the Fox propaganda machine and say that there's some kind of coup going on and try and purge the FBI and the Justice Department. And they may even fire Mueller at any moment. That's all going on. But as you say, the economy's doing well. And if you go to the Carville adage, it's the economy, stupid, then are the Republicans in good shape in 2018?
Well, I think a lot really depends on how the Democrats play it. I mean, the corruption is clear as day. You have a guy in the White House who's threatening war with North Korea and, you know, may mean it. Who the hell knows? That rightly has people scared, disgusted. So that does make them incredibly unpopular. But I worry the economy could play into their hands, and especially if the Democrats try to portray that this is some sort of economic disaster when it isn't. It is an outrage that they're giving more money to the richest people in the country, and basically it's a straight-out, you know, old-fashioned pork barrel stuff where these guys are going, well, we get to vote out. Why not we vote ourselves big piles of money? And that's what they did. You know, so that rightly disgusts people. And that is tremendously unpopular. But if we try and say, oh, and now the economy is going to sink because of it, well, that's not true.
So what's your sense then of whether the Democrats can measure their criticism? My sense is that the country's really ripe, I think, for champions of antitrust, for champions of the middle class and working Americans in the real sense. And I think, you know, people are palpably aware of the growing income gap.
That's right. And Democrats really have to seize on that. Whether they're prepared to or not, You know, I just can't say. I think obviously many of them are. Certainly you have people like Bernie Sanders. I guess not a Democrat, but you know, Bernie Sanders, of course, and Elizabeth Warren. I mean, you could point to people within the party who have been champions of working people, but you still have plenty of people who've been close to Wall Street, close to Silicon Valley interest. And those people don't necessarily want to see working people have better lives.
So is the support then for this so-called tax reform bill in the Fox bubble, how do you penetrate that bubble? I mean, is there an argument that you can make to the working people? And Trump, after all, ran as an economic populist. He ran against Wall Street, I might remind you. And he tried to paint Hillary Clinton as a creature of Wall Street. And now he's got this giveaway to Wall Street, which they're selling as a boost for the working Americans and the middle class. And that's what they said in front of the with the big photo op yesterday.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's hard to say that this is money going to the richest people in the country. It was designed, you know, during the campaign, of course, Trump was trashing Clinton for her speech at Goldman Sachs. Well, who's his chief economic advisor? Gary Cohn, who was Goldman Sachs. Mnuchin, who was at Goldman Sachs. In fact, his dad was at Goldman Sachs. He's Goldman Sachs' child. So it's not, it's quite truthful to say this is money going to the richest people in the country. You know, I made the joke that he promised to drain the swamp. He's swamping the drain. He's just filling us up with garbage. And that's not a hard point to make because it's just very obviously true. Again, it's not going to crash the economy, but I think people are rightly disgusted by seeing these people lining, using their political positions to line their pockets.
So then there is, as we've discussed, the time is right for a real economic populist. We saw it, a glimpse of it from the last campaign. Bernie Sanders came out of nowhere and got an enormous amount of support. Do you think the Democratic Party is going to move in that direction? Are they going to start sort of getting rid of their Wall Street ties? Because if they don't, and the Republicans are on a roll and the economy is doing well, then I don't see them doing, you know, everybody tells you they're going to sweep, they're going to win back the House, possibly the Senate. I'd say not so fast.
They have to give people a positive agenda. They have to say, we're about extending health care, we're about education, whatever it is. I mean, they could put down several issues, but, you know, make it clear, these are things we're going to do for you if we get in office. Now, obviously, as long as Donald Trump's in the White House, he'll probably veto anything, but at least you could say, this is our agenda, this is what we're going to push. If they're saying, we're just going to take back the tax cut, I think it's going to look very foolish.
So, in the end, we've all been hosed, and they're lucky that they have a good economy, and frankly, the guy that he trashes and vilifies along with Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, should get some credit for that, but it doesn't work like that, does it?
Well, you should get some. The other person who really deserves an awful lot is the person who just fired his Fed chair, Janet Yellen, who really has done an outstanding job. I mean, she managed to steer the economy through this. I won't say I always agreed with everything she did, but the point was she steered the economy. She kept it going along. We have no problem with inflation now, and we have a economy that's doing pretty well. So Obama deserves some credit again. I wish he had had more spending, more stimulus earlier, but, you know, he gets credit for turning the economy around, and I think Yellen in particular for holding it on a steady course. And unfortunately, she has the misfortune to be the first Fed chair not to be reappointed in I don't know how long, quite some time.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us, and I wish you happy holidays and a Merry Christmas.
You too.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And his latest book is Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Bubbles Are Back. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of the unpopular tax bill, whether or not it will help the Republicans or hurt them in 2018. We'll be talking to President Obama's former chief economic advisor.
of people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jason Furman, a professor of the practice of economic policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Previously, he served 8 years as the top economic advisor to President Obama, including serving as the 28th chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, acting as both President Obama's chief economist and a member of the cabinet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Furman.
Thanks for having me.
And what's your sense then of, we have two narratives out there, that this is the most unpopular so-called tax reform bill in memory, and it's going to basically reward corporate America and the donors along with the super rich who don't really need that windfall. At the same time, you've got the head of Bank of America and Comcast and other big corporations saying they're going to give their workers a bonus, not a raise, but a bonus of $1,000. And there's a great deal of optimism that this is going to, you know, trickle down and boost the economy. So which of the two narratives do you believe?
First of all, thank you for having me on your show. And I, you know, want to start out by saying our tax code really would have benefited from a genuine tax reform. I've worked more on the topic of tax reform than any other policy issue for the last 8 years. And I do think it makes sense to lower our corporate rate, to have a more investment-friendly climate, to end an international system that's broken, that distorts business decisions while also not collecting revenue. But I think at the same time, you don't want to do all of that at the expense of the middle class, at the expense of the budget deficit, at the expense of our economic future. So I think this particular form of tax reform is going to end up being one that's in the long run damaging to the U.S. economy. Might get a little extra growth for a year or two because you're pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy, and even a badly designed hundreds of billions of dollars stimulus, you're going to get a little bit out of. But over time, that'll go away and turn negative. You know, in terms of these announcements you cited, you should read absolutely nothing into those. The companies that are making these announcements are heavily regulated companies that have business before the government. They're just trying to curry favor with President Trump. That has nothing to do with economics. It's all about politics.
But as one who served in the Obama administration, and particularly as a chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, how does it strike you, and it seems incredibly ironic to me, that the CHIPS program, for example, is not being renewed, and it's hardly coincidental that that was started by Hillary Clinton, who has been vilified by Donald Trump to the point that you wonder whether she actually won the election and not him. And then, two, the other person who's been vilified relentlessly is Barack Obama, and almost everything that he's done is being very cynically and deliberately undone. Yet Barack Obama handed Donald Trump an incredibly good economy that was revived from a near-death experience. And isn't that what's really going on here, that we just have a good economy and Trump is incredibly lucky to inherit it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that when Obama walked in the door, he had inherited a complete mess and walked out of the door and left things in pretty good shape for his successor. Not perfect. Wage growth, for example, is not as high as I would like it to be. I'd like to see that go higher, but a lot of momentum. The other thing, by the way, is the global economy. A couple of years ago, we had turmoil in China. Before that, the Eurozone crisis. There were a lot of external headwinds on the U.S. economy. Now we've seen global growth rates rising, and so the rest of the world is actually helping the U.S. economy right now. And you know, the problem, I think, is that a tax cut like this is going to squander that momentum. I mean, we don't need hundreds of billions of dollars of tax cuts for high-income households and corporations over the next year or two. We don't need a stimulus plan right now. And if you needed a stimulus plan, that's not the way I would design it.
And in terms of the promises as opposed to the reality, I know there was an awful lot of self-congratulation going on and a lot of sycophancy and praise of Donald Trump, both at the cabinet and at the photo op. But one of the promises, of course, was that we'd be doing our taxes on a postcard. My understanding is that this is actually going to be more complicated. The IRS is going to be working even harder. And the Republicans, of course, are relentlessly cutting the budget of the IRS.
Yeah. I mean, that last point is very important, by the way, is that the IRS has a smaller budget than it's had, and it has to deal with a really complicated new law. And where a lot of the complications are is depending on how you describe your income and depending on how you earn your income, you can pay tax rates anywhere from 37% if it's regular income, or more like 30% if it's a pass-through, or 20% if it's a corporation. And, you know, through effort, you can get yourself from 37 to 30 or from 30 to 20. And, you know, the people who need to patrol that are the IRS, and they're not going to be up to the task just in terms of the resources they have for them. So, yeah, there are a lot of new complications. And the problem is the new complications are the type that if you're really sophisticated and have good lawyers and accountants, you can benefit from those complications.
And the other issue that, first of all, there were no hearings, there was no transparency, the Democrats weren't included. So what we've learned about the process has been very spotty, to say the least. But one of the people that sort of got a lot of attention, of course, was Bob Corker, because he was a no vote, and at the last minute his vote switched. And he was a no vote largely because he's a deficit hawk, and they've increased the deficit by $1.5 trillion and somehow satisfied him that the rising economy will somehow magically disappear that deficit. A lot of other analysts say that there's actually a cynical agenda here, is that the Republicans don't mind blowing up the debt because then they can come back in a year and say, well, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut Social Security and Medicaid. And by the way, you know, a part of this bill is, of course, an attack on Obamacare, which Donald Trump just yesterday said he succeeded in killing it. So that's an extraordinary thing to even celebrate, the idea that millions of Americans lose their health care, and that's something to cheer about.
Yeah, well, I mean, and by the way, on Obamacare, the New York Times just reported that the sign-ups this year for the marketplaces are almost the same as what they were last year, even though the sign-up period was half as long. The government put no effort into helping people sign up, and it's put lots of effort into destabilizing the exchange. So just like I was predicting a year ago, there certainly were some bumps along the way with premiums and some rate hikes, but that's really stabilized things. And you know, Obamacare really, really is working, and it's working despite the best attempts of the administration to sabotage it, something that they brag about doing. But yes, more broadly, you're exactly right. If you want to ask what will the effect of this tax cut be on people, you can't just look at the law that Congress passed. You have to ask what else will happen in the future as a result of that law. And the next step is cutting so-called welfare programs. And you know, a lot of the ones that the Republicans, especially the administration, President Trump, have targeted are programs like Medicaid, food stamps, things that help support some of the most vulnerable in our society.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Furman, a professor of the practice of economic policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Previously, he served 8 years as a top economic advisor to President Obama, including serving as the 28th chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, acting as both President Obama's chief economist and a member of the cabinet. So what's your sense then of how this is going to play in 2018? Are we going to, you know, we have a president with the lowest approval ratings since they did polling, I believe. There's an expectation that the Democrats could take the House and even the Senate. There's this millstone around Trump's neck of the Russia inquiry, although there are rumors that he may even fire the special counsel, and we know that Fox News has been beating the drum for him to do so, and now there are inquiries into the FBI and the very people who are looking into the possible collusion or ties between the Trump administration and Russia, or the Trump campaign in Russia. These will obviously serve to distract from the central issue. But by and large, most of the punditry has given the Democrats a great deal of wind at their back and optimism. But at the same time, how do you think the economy is? I mean, one has to keep going back, I think, to James Carville's adage, it's the economy, stupid. So are the Democrats getting just too optimistic here?
You know, I'm not a political scientist. I'm an economist, so I don't have a confident answer to your question. I think to some degree people vote based on, you know, less the details of how public policy affects them and more their sense about what that public policy was about. And I think there is a strong sense, and I think it's a largely accurate sense, that this tax cut had permanent tax cuts for corporations, paid for by a set of temporary tax changes for individuals at sunset and are replaced by tax increases. So the priority here was corporations, wasn't individuals, and that the tax bill gives much larger tax cuts to high-income households than it does to middle or low-income households. So I think, regardless of how the economy performs, if people think that this tax cut is contrary to the type of populism that they heard and may have chosen to vote for last year, I think people would be accurate in that impression.
And can you make a case that we've talked about how the advertising, the postcard, hasn't exactly worked out, but the idea of bringing jobs back? We all saw that extraordinary exchange where a bunch of CEOs were asked whether getting these corporate tax cuts would suddenly mean that they could increase employment, and very few put up their hands, and Gary Cohn was chagrined by that. But the idea that we're going to bring back all that money overseas, my sense is, and from what I've tried to analyze, and again, we haven't had much of an opportunity to look at this thing because it's been done in secret. My understanding is that maybe none of that's true about bringing all that money back. What's in it, do you think, that's a real incentive for corporate America and even the big corporations like Apple that people think are relatively virtuous, that there's going to be the floodgates of all that treasure stashed abroad will suddenly flood back into the United States?
So let's talk about Apple for a moment, because it's a really good illustration of this point. I'm going to get these numbers, I'm not exactly right here, but they're order of magnitude right. Apple has something like $300 billion overseas and something like $30 billion of cash in the United States. Apple invests only a couple billion dollars a year in the United States. If Apple wanted to expand its investment, it has more than enough cash in the United States already to expand that investment. Plus, it can borrow really cheaply in the bond market. So the thing that's been holding Apple back from building factories in the United States has been a business decision about, you know, the cost of labor and the like. It hasn't been that Apple can't afford the upfront cost of building that factory. So that's point number one. These companies have a lot of cash in America already. Having more cash in America won't change their investment in America. Point number two, that $300 billion overseas, at least for most companies, I don't know about Apple in particular, but for most companies, that cash is actually already in the United States. It's on the balance sheet of a foreign subsidiary, but that foreign subsidiary actually has invested it already in the American financial system. So there's just this, a lot of this is just accounting entries that are going to be shifted around to the benefit of shareholders, not any real economic activity associated with that shifting.
So what is at the end of the day, the truth about whether this new tax reform bill is going to repatriate money and stimulate our economy and give us jobs?
It will have more money on the balance sheet of Apple. instead of Apple Ireland or Apple, you know, whatever their subsidiaries are, and I don't know what Apple's subsidiaries are. So money will, in an accounting sense, be repatriated, but that is not the same as additional investment and job creation in the United States. I would expect very little of that.
Well, just in closing, you started out by saying that we should have had tax reform, and essentially we haven't got it. Can we get it if the Democrats take back the House in 2018? Can they reverse what's been done?
Well, the biggest thing that needs to be reversed is that we're not collecting enough revenue now. We need to collect more revenue to fund the type of government we want. I'd love to see that done in the smartest possible way. And, you know, I think there are ways to do that through reforming the tax code. But I think just about anything would beat the situation that we have now. And I do think we also need to look at other revenue sources like carbon taxes that align incentives and help solve another problem while also dealing with our fiscal future.
And that, of course, is global warming, which is not being solved because we have a denier in the White House. So I thank you for joining us, Jason Furman. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Furman, who's a professor of the practice of economic policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Previously, he served 8 years as the top economic advisor to President Obama, including serving as the 28th chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, acting as both President Obama's chief economist and a member of the cabinet. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the fate of the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP.
It's the money.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. More money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joan Alker, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, where her work focuses on health coverage for low-income children and families, with an emphasis on Medicaid, Affordable Care Act, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Alker.
Thank you for having me.
And Joan, CHIP is in limbo. It hasn't been renewed. There doesn't seem to be much interest on the part of the Republicans. There's certainly no sense of urgency. And it's pretty hard to stomach that nonchalance in the face of this massive tax cut given to the super wealthy and to corporate America in this so-called tax reform bill that will soon be signed by President Trump. What's your explanation for, I don't know how you responded to all of those Republicans cheering yesterday and all of that sycophancy that went on in the cabinet meeting where they were lavishing praise on Donald Trump, in particular the vice president. They're all extremely pleased with themselves, but I'm sort of reminded of the hundreds of thousands of young kids in this country that will soon go hungry.
Well, yesterday we released a report showing that if Congress does not enact a full five-year extension of the CHIP program, we're going to start seeing children losing coverage in January. And I think this is a very situation, a real dereliction of duty on Congress's part this year. Let's think back throughout the year. Congress spent a lot of time trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act and slash the Medicaid program. So cutting health care to families. Yet CHIP is a popular, successful, bipartisan program. They say they like CHIP. They said they were going to get it done, but they haven't got it done. So I think this is a terrible message to send to families as we head into this holiday season, that coverage for children is at risk.
So is there an element, though, of spite in this? Because we know that Donald Trump is obsessed with undoing everything that Barack Obama did. And he's been vilifying Hillary Clinton relentlessly, and to the point where one would think that she won the election and not him. And now they're trying to revive the uranium story, which is a non-manufactured scandal. So they're still beating up on Hillary Clinton. And it's my understanding that Hillary Clinton is largely responsible for the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, being instituted in the first place.
No, I don't think that's exactly right. The Children's Health Insurance Program was passed in 1997, and the key sponsors of that was a real bipartisan effort from Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, who today is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and Senator Ted Kennedy, a Democrat from Massachusetts. So CHIP was really born in a bipartisan spirit, and it's interesting because Senator Hatch considers CHIP one of his greatest accomplishments. So this program really has had bipartisan support. I think this is evidence of Congress's dysfunction and the fact they've wasted so much time this year trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, not getting a lot done. And you know, it's really kind of shocking that they haven't got it over the finish line, because CHIP is one of the only areas I can think of healthcare policy. They've actually had bipartisan agreement on the policy since September. But when the Senate reached that agreement in the Finance Committee, it quickly got bumped off the agenda by another repeal effort. So it's come down to the wire here and caught up in larger issues. And it seems to be being used as a bargaining chip, no pun intended at this point. And that's very unfortunate. I'll just note the bipartisan National Governors Association just called on Congress to do a five-year extension. They're leaving states holding the bag here, and they're leaving families with no peace of mind as they head into the holidays.
So, Jonelka, how does then does one explain the praise and sense of accomplishment that we saw yesterday from Senator Orrin Hatch, who praised Donald Trump as a great leader and the tax bill as one of the great steps forward? No mention of CHIP.
Yeah, I mean, I really can't speak for Senator Hatch. He has said repeatedly this year that CHIP would get done by the end of the year. And, of course, here we are at the end of the year, and it's not over till it's over, but it looks like CHIP's not going to get done. So that's extremely disappointing. It's really no way to run a program. And one of the most discouraging things is that, as a country, it's something we can all be proud of. In 2016, we saw the uninsured rate for children reach its lowest level. We have over 95% of children in this country covered now, which many people don't realize that. And this is really for years of effort through Medicaid and CHIP. Even before we had the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid and CHIP have been working together to reduce coverage for children. And all of this back and forth has already undermined confidence in the program. So the CHIP program has been damaged already by this inaction, and every day that this goes on, it really leaves states and families in a bind.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonelka, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, where her work focuses on health coverage for low-income children and families, with an emphasis on Medicaid, Affordable Care Act, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. So my understanding is that we're talking about, and now that, you know, we're just poised, the president's poised to sign a so-called tax reform bill that will add $1.5 trillion to the deficit and the debt on the assumption that this will stimulate the economy and pay for itself. And that's essentially free money for the beneficiaries, which are largely being corporate America and the very, very wealthy. They're the ones who get the windfall from this new tax bill. So we're talking about trillions of dollars. And yet, as far as I know, CHIP comes to what, $14 billion a year over a 10-year period, about $140 billion. Is that right?
Yeah, and actually the cost is even less. The way the congressional budget processing works, which, as you know, can be pretty complex, the Congressional Budget Office, who's the official scorekeeper, has said that Congress only needs to come up with $8.5 billion for a five-year extension of CHIP. So that's less than one-half of 1% of the budget. It obviously pales in comparison to the addition to the deficit we just saw. So to say that they can't come up with the money for this is ridiculous.
So obviously this is something that concerns you, since this is your work. What have you been able to figure out or find out? Have you? I assume you've talked to people on the Hill, right?
I mean, it concerns me because we know that it is very short-sighted and dangerous for children to go without health coverage. You know, even a short break in coverage means kids are likely to miss needed preventive and primary care. If you have a child with asthma, they need to get their meds, and if they don't, they may wind up in the ER. So this is very short-sighted. We know that children who are insured have better educational outcomes, are more likely to graduate from high school. So it's just a terrible path we're on right now. Rather than celebrating the fact that 95% of our kids have had coverage finally and trying to improve on that, Congress is taking a step backwards here. So, you know, again, I think it speaks to the level of dysfunction. Other than the tax bill, they've basically not been able to get anything done this year. And it is a mystery, though, when they all say they're for it, and everybody has said they're for the five-year extension, why they couldn't get it over the finish line.
So we've sort of discussed, well, I don't know that we've pointed out who's dragging their heels on this, but let me ask you, who's your champion, or who are your champions here trying to do the right thing?
I mean, I think there's really a great deal of support for this program from many quarters. There is, as I just mentioned, the National Governors Association, which represents all the governors, has just put out a very strong letter saying this needs to be extended for 5 years now. There are, again, what's concerning is that there are many people who say, many senators and Congress people who say they support CHIP, but again, it's very much in peril of not getting done. So at the end of the day, what's most important is what families need, and what they need is the peace of mind that their child will go without health coverage. And it seems that their child will have health coverage. And it seems that Congress is going to leave town without delivering that.
And when could you hope that they will do the right thing? And what kind of limbo are the kids going to be in?
Right. Well, so the continuing resolution that I believe the House just passed moments ago extends government funding through January 19th. So that means they'll have to come back at these questions in January as soon as they return. This is a few times now that Congress has kicked the can down the road, not only on CHIP, but even on something as basic as keeping the government running. But I expect that they will be considering this issue immediately again in January when they return. It's a very dysfunctional way of running a program. We have states that already have sent notices to families telling them that their coverage is in jeopardy because of congressional inaction. And that does real damage to the program. So, you know, of course, the sooner they fund it, the better. But it's important to recognize that the damage has already been done to the CHIP program by these constant delays.
And where is the greatest need in the CHIP program in terms of the sort of red state, blue state divide? I don't know whether the politics of it are that this is more popular with Democrats than Republicans. You said that it's always been bipartisan, starting out with Senator Ted Kennedy, the Democrat, and Senator Orrin Hatch, the Republican. So can you fill us in on how this works politically in terms of who supports it the most, and then where the program is most needed in what states?
Yeah, well, it's really needed everywhere, but let's talk about who the program is serving. The program is serving working families who are earning just a little bit too much so that they can't qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to be able to afford private insurance. So we're talking about a constituency that I think is very much a constituency that both parties would like to claim they represent. But interestingly, because of some pretty complex rules in the CHIP program, states can choose to run their CHIP program in one of two ways. They can extend Medicaid coverage, or they can set up a separate state program. And the separate state program is actually probably more common in red states. Texas and Florida both have separate state programs. A lot of states have combinations. But children in those separate state programs are actually more at risk, because children in Medicaid, even if Congress doesn't fund CHIP, will remain covered, but with much less federal money. So those states will take a hit, but for now the children won't lose coverage. So it is children in those separate state programs who are around the country, but as I say, tend to be more clustered in red states, who are particularly at risk of losing coverage.
And what gets covered? A full spectrum of health care?
Yes. CHIP has comprehensive benefits. There are some variations state to state, but in general it has a very strong benefit that meets the needs of kids, moving from preventive care, dental care, and inpatient care should it come to that. And that's why we know CHIP is a program designed to meet kids' needs, and it is definitely a better option for them than any alternative that those families would have should the program go away. Many of those children would become uninsured. Some of them might find their way to the marketplace or other private insurance that would be far less affordable and less comprehensive, specifically designed with kids in mind.
Well, the fact that it covers dental, I think, is so interesting and such a of such great benefit, because we've seen with all the Affordable Care Act to and fro, and the, you know, the many, many, what, 50 or plus 60 attempts to kill it and the efforts to repeal it. One of the things that I was always struck by, and I don't know whether you've ever dealt with these people that go around mostly in rural America with volunteer health services, and I interviewed some of the people that run this program, and they go, you know, from city to city and town to town, mostly in rural America, and people just come by the thousands for health care, and most of them, and this is free, and they have doctors and nurses and x-ray machines and all that stuff ready to go, all volunteer. And the guy that ran the program said to me, he said, you know, when we ask people when they first show up, put your hand up, do you want medical care? And a few hands go up. Do you want eye care? A few more hands go up. Do you want dental care? And so many more hands come up. So to my mind, it's an extraordinary thing that we have a lot of healthcare coverage and debates about it, but we don't have a lot of dental care coverage. And the fact that CHIP has it, I think, is very impressive.
Yes, I mean, there's a little bit of variation state to state, but most states are either offering the Medicaid benefit package, the pediatric package, which does include dental, and many separate CHIP programs are offering that as well. So it is a huge need and very important for children and, as you say, for adults. But that's one of the many things that kids need. Obviously, they need regular checkups, and they have frequent issues that arise, like an ear infection or something they need antibiotics for so it doesn't get worse. And then, of course, we know that children frequently break bones, have accidents. There are many things that are easily dealt with, but if you're uninsured, that can cause a very serious medical debt that will stick with you potentially for years, even if the family has a child uncovered for a brief period.
So isn't there some concern, though, that Medicaid is on the chopping block?
Well, during the past year in the ACA repeal debate, there were very extensive Medicaid cuts proposed as part of the repeal. So, excuse me, let's hope that next year Congress moves off that. I think they ended up having a lot of opposition to the Medicaid cuts that were very substantial, but certainly given that the deficit is going up now as a result of the tax bill, I do expect Medicaid to remain in the crosshairs, unfortunately, and be targeted for cuts.
Well, just in closing then, I would have thought, though, that as a nation, you know, we all care for children and they're vulnerable and they're innocent. And as much as the adults can argue politics and wrangle as they do, one would think that there'd be sort of extra care and compassion directed at children. And at some extent, as a nation, as a people, we'd be judged by whether we care about our children. As the Bible says, the least among thee. I mean, so this is the part that I wonder about. Are we becoming a less compassionate, more selfish nation?
Well, I can only say that, as I said before, we have reached 95% coverage, and that has taken many years to get there, and it's something I think we should be proud of and be building on rather than putting at risk.
And what's your message for our listeners? I mean, a lot of people are going to be upset. They already are upset, I think. They understand that the unfairness of abandoning children while rewarding millionaires and billionaires. What should our audience do?
Well, I think certainly folks need to let their members of Congress know that it's unacceptable to risk children's health care like this. Any lapse in coverage is not okay. And this should be a national priority. Not only does it provide economic security and peace of mind to families, it's very fiscally short-sighted to have kids who have treatable conditions like asthma wind up in the emergency room and miss school. I mean, this is not a way to build a strong future for our country. So children's health care is really essential in so many ways. It's an essential building block for a successful future. For our country, and that's the bottom line here.
Well, Joan Alker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joan Alker, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, where her work focuses on health coverage for low-income children and families, with an emphasis on Medicaid, Affordable Care Act, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. I hope you all have a happy holiday and a Merry Christmas. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was